Doug Rocky. Hey, the sun finally came out a little bit, but it's a cold and rainy day here in Illinois, and we're warming up somewhat. Well, today we're going to have a very interesting discussion because we're having a change of pace from what we've normally done, and we've got a very unique guest today. This is a professor of English, an author, a Lincoln scholar. I got to meet him several years ago. This last Friday night, I had a distinct pleasure to listen to him as he read some of his poetry. And, wow, I don't even know where to begin this. Welcome, Dan. Welcome to Warrior Connection.
Oh, it's great to be here, Doug.
Well, you've had a really busy week. I mean, last Friday night, you were at the Rantoul Public Library for a regional local author's fair, and you read out of your poetry book, House Poems, which just stopped the show. And then you went on, and there was a major event, the Lincoln Museum, wasn't there also?
Yes, a new book that just came out called Gettysburg Replies, and it's a it was sponsored by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation. That's a mouthful, but basically they're a support group that helps to raise money for the museum, which, like all institutions of that kind, is not getting the kind of funding from government sources that it once did. And so I was happy to participate. There were 100 people in the book, including all the living presidents and various people that had Lincoln connections, like Steven Spielberg, for example, for the Lincoln movie. And there were a number of service personnel, some who were from the USS Lincoln. And the idea behind the book was that you would write a response to the Gettysburg Address, but it had to be exactly the same number of words, which is 272 words.
I think it's astonishing when we look at that. On that day when they had it, the previous speaker went for over 2 hours,
yeah,
and then Abraham Lincoln got over, and it was done in less than 3 minutes. And that speech has gone on to live in eternity, where all of us had to memorize it.
and the fellow who spoke so long wrote Lincoln a note the next day saying, "You did more in your few minutes than I did in a couple of hours." Which is, everybody thought that Lincoln had just begun the address, that he, you know, this was his introduction or preface, and they were all waiting for the speech, so they were shocked when he stepped out from the podium.
Yeah, how did that begin? I mean, there are so many stories about the Gettysburg Address, but, I mean, ladies and gentlemen, and Dan, it's so incredible to have an opportunity to know you as a true Lincoln scholar. I mean, you're one of the greats.
Oh, I wouldn't. There are some great ones out there. I wouldn't put myself in that category, but I try. I've been studying Lincoln since 1985, but that doesn't mean anything. There's so much out there, and more every year.
On the Gettysburg Address and everything, I mean, there are so many conversations and discussions on that. Was it extraneous? Because he was always an author and a speaker where he liked to prepare all of his stuff completely ahead of time, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah, it wasn't extempore at all. And you're right. He had mulled it over. He had worked on it on the train from Washington to Gettysburg. It's not a very long distance. I've driven it, and certainly not a difficult journey by train. But Lincoln liked to literally, and I have a poem about this. He literally liked to cut and paste. So he didn't get to do that with the Gettysburg Address because he was still working on it. But he would have the government printer make up what we would think of as a rough printed copy. There weren't any computers around, mind you. No tablets, desktops, or anything like that. But he would have him. This was, of course, once he was president. Before, he would write them out all longhand. Sometimes many versions of them with scratch outs and so forth. Anyhow, he would then get this proof copy back, and then he would literally paste, cut and paste, which again we use as a computer term today, but he would literally cut and paste revisions and paste them over the original and then send that back to the printing office, and then that would get printed. That's what happened, for example, with the second inaugural.
It seems so astonishing, man. Man, I've written other books, and there's a book that's over at the Lincoln Museum that I did pick up on, Lincoln and the Telegraph. He was the first president to really use the telegraph for directing troops and everything else, getting messages out.
He was
cutting and pasting like we talk about today in the computer age.
Yeah, he was just very. Here's a guy who had grown up really in the boondocks of Kentucky and southern Indiana in the 1830s and 40s, and comes to Illinois and winds up in the little village of New Salem, which was just a dot on the map. And he finds it wasn't just the telegraph, Doug. He was the first president to use the train extensively. He also, and this I think is the really important technology that he latched onto, the photograph. We have more photographs of Lincoln than of any other 19th century politician, and that's no accident. I mean, he quickly figured out that you get your likeness out there, and he would make jokes about, you know, his hair or his homely appearance or whatever. But people in those days, instead of a business card, they had what they called a carte de visite, which was basically a business card, and you would often have your picture of the on the back of it, and you could write a message or have your name printed on the other side or whatever. Well, we have lots of those of Lincoln's cards that still survive, and of course he was in any number of photographs that were made of him for campaign purposes.
So, and the other thing, too, I mean, the other thing, and you talk about this in your book, in your different books and everything, I mean, Abraham Lincoln, President Lincoln, really was a master at networking and putting together all of the pieces, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I would say that is not just, you know, sort of out in the field. There's a great funny story, if I can tell this for a minute, a short story, but after the Battle of Vicksburg, which Grant won. It was reported to Lincoln was very much hands-on. He was always, you know, conferring with his generals and so forth. And again, here's a guy who did have some military experience. He had fought in the Black Hawk War in Illinois and was actually elected captain of his company by his men. He was very proud of that. He said he was more proud of that election than any other. So he had a little bit of military background, but he hadn't formally studied tactics or anything like that, although he did during the war, and he loved to talk with his generals. But anyhow, when General Grant had a victory at Vicksburg, and this tended to turn the tide of the war, and after that the war really took place, if you drew a circle around Richmond and Washington, D.C., Richmond, Virginia, and Washington, D.C., you pretty much have the theater of the war thereafter. It was pretty much concentrated there, especially, you know, it ended in Appomattox. But anyhow, everybody's complaining about that. Well, Grant, you know, he's not that great of a general. You know, they were basically trying to downplay Grant's victory, and they said, besides that, you know, he drinks a lot. He's got a problem with liquor. And Lincoln said, this is the line I love. He said, find out what he's drinking and send a case of that to all my other generals.
Well, considering that Grant went on, you know, won those battles and went on to win the Civil War, and still. And I think this is in the history books, and for me as a military officer, it's astonishing.
Yeah, and
Grant,
he had a lot of trouble with
General Lee at the surrender was astonishing.
Yeah. Lee, a lot of people don't know this, but Lee was one of the foremost middle-grade officers during the Mexican War, and he served as a scout. He was basically what we would think of as Delta Forces today, you know, going out by himself on little recon missions into the Mexican line and so forth, and was the favorite of the commanding officers, and that's one of the reasons he was offered the command of the Union Army at the beginning of the war, but turned it down because he didn't want to fight against his home state of Virginia. But
well, his home farm and everything is now our Arlington National Cemetery, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And that was kind of a cruel joke, if you will, on the part of the Union Army by taking control of Arlington early on. And but it also became the National Cemetery. Yeah, Lee's just extraordinary. But there were a lot of other, you know, Grant was more of a general in the mold of someone like Eisenhower. You know, he had lots of troops, he had lots of resources, he had especially food and uniforms and cannonballs, and he was able to essentially stretch the Confederate line so thin that it was stretching from Petersburg, Virginia, all the way out to Appomattox Courthouse, so that there was a greater and greater distance between each individual man. And Lee was able to send his, Grant was able to send his armies through those lines, and that was the end of the war.
Now, one of the things that's astonishing is I've read your books before, and I have great joy in them. You know, one of the books, and you talk about it, that Abraham Lincoln, as he was growing up and everything, probably the foundations that were put in place for him to be so against slavery and everything came about from his upbringing, because as I read and learned in your book, his father actually basically hired him out or rented him out as an indentured servant and then kept all of the proceeds, didn't he?
Yeah, and that's one of the things, and I take a little more extreme view on that. Some people kind of downplay that, but I view, but not all, including the most recent and famous biography of Lincoln, which is by a man named Michael Burlingame, who now is the Lincoln professor at the University of Illinois in Springfield. As a matter of fact, Lincoln, I would go so far as to say that he was an abused child. I mean, Lincoln was batted around by his father. Burlingame, in his biography, points out slapped around. I mean, I don't think they were, you know, he wasn't lacerated or anything like that. But he was frequently slapped in the face by his father because Lincoln was very curious. He loved conversation, and so he wanted to talk to. They lived in the middle of nowhere, so when a visitor would show up, Lincoln wanted, and was smart and understood what was going on in the conversation. He wanted to join in, and his father didn't like that at all. Children were supposed to be seen and not heard in those days. So he and his, and also Lincoln would occasionally let the plow, you know, just sit there in the field with the mule hitched up to it and sit under a tree and read a book. And this just infuriated his father. So there was, Burlingame makes the point that Lincoln may well have talked back to his father, and I'd say there's probably, we don't have a video or a tape recording, but I'd say that's a pretty good likelihood. And they were about as different as two people could be. Both of his mothers, his birth mother and his foster mother, were just very loving and supportive.
Now, when Abraham Lincoln, when they left Indiana, they headed over to not too far from where you are right now, just on the west side of Decatur, Illinois.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where his family first set out and set foot in Illinois, correct? But then they moved then over to Goose Prairie or Charleston or something?
Yes. Well, they stayed very, very briefly in the area and then moved to, just near Lerna, Illinois. Southwest of Charleston, and in a place called Goose Nest Prairie. You're right, and there's a long story there, and I have some poem about that in my book. That Thomas was just a subsistence farmer. He would grow just enough to feed the family for that winter, but not beyond. So he never really made any money, you know, didn't accumulate wealth. And there's a farm right next door to the Lincoln farm run by a guy named Sargent. And the contrast is really quite dramatic. Sargent became very, same land area, he became very prosperous and, you know, bought more land and so forth. I don't think that's who Thomas Lincoln was. And it may be, oddly enough, it may be one of the reasons that Abraham was so ambitious. And he was ambitious. Don't kid yourself about that. I mean, I think he wanted to be president from day one. And his wife, of course, Mary, when she married him, she told everyone, because she spotted this in him, and she had said all along, I will marry the next president of the United States.
Now, Mary Todd Lincoln, again, you've talked about this in your book, and I've heard it in other things. For that time frame, at the 1840s, she was extremely educated, extremely articulate, extremely
right.
social conscious and everything, wasn't she?
Yes, she came from the most famous political family in Kentucky, the Todd family, they were very good friends of Henry Clay, who lived right down the road from them, who was nationally known and one of Lincoln's heroes. So it's small wonder that Abraham and Mary should be attracted to one another. The other thing, of course, is that she was sent to this finishing school where she learned to speak French. She spoke fluent French. But the real kicker is the fact that she would sit in on political discussions, which often occurred in the parlor at her father's home there in Lexington, Kentucky. And it was said, and this sounds a little sexist today, but this was quite a compliment, you're saying, for the 1840s, that she could talk politics like a man.
That's something else. I mean, so she ended up in Indian Edwards' house in Springfield, Illinois, where she met Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
He had been out basically just living in New Salem as a storekeeper. He was obviously, what we call today the Illinois Army National Guard commander.
Yeah, he was in the militia, right. Yeah.
And then he went on, and eventually he started studying the law and everything else and was in the Illinois State Legislature. He's one of the guys that, the tall group that got the Capitol to Springfield, Illinois?
Yes, the long nine, and that's the other thing. He starts out, if you look at his career, he's not a hack politician, but he's very much a party politician. He was a Whig, and the Whigs were the forerunners of what became the Republican Party. They were essentially the opposition party, and they were essentially the party. And this is really kind of funny when you look at how things are today, but they were the party of freer money. I always like to tell people when I give talks that Lincoln would have loved the Discover Card. He thought that there should be lots of credit because Lincoln saw the country as this great, potentially booming landscape that just needed a little kickstart so to have the middle class come in, farm it, build factories, build farms, and raise children and lots of food. And to do that, you needed credit. The Democrats on the other side, and this was largely because of Andrew Jackson, old Hickory, who was just tough about this, he refused to loosen up the money. And this all centers on whether or not we would have a national bank that would lend out more money. And so Lincoln wanted to see credit available for the little guy so that you could start a farm, start a grocery store, whatever. He was very much middle-class oriented. In it, and very much ahead of his time. A couple other facts along this line. Lincoln believed that women should be able to vote. He was horrified by the treatment of Catholics and Jews, which was really reprehensible during this period. And Catholics generally meant the Irish. Lincoln, and of course, he was, most people don't realize this, but the Illinois legislature came within a couple of votes of voting in slavery. Lincoln was one of the few. There was one other politician. His name was Dan Stone. And he just arrived in Vandalia. He's a young legislator. And one of his first acts is to vote against making Illinois a slave state. And that may sound pretty obvious to us today, but that was a brave action. There were a lot of slaves running around in Illinois who were being passed off as indentured servants. There was a lot of pro-slavery sentiment, and that continued throughout the Civil War, the so-called Copperheads. There were Union soldiers killed just before the end of the war on the square in Charleston, Illinois.
The Sons of the Confederacy, I mean, there is a line that runs down there through basically Mattoon, and that right through the whole South beyond that was a Confederacy at this time. I mean, kind of part of the history. One thing that I learned from your book, and I'd also learned, and it was kind of hidden at the museum, but it's there, is that Lincoln was a U.S. congressman.
Oh, yeah. And there, too, he got in trouble for speaking his mind. I mean, I think he's a very brave person. I mean, as I always tell people, anytime you try to put a jacket on Lincoln or put him in a particular little box, he has a way of wiggling out. yes, he was a politician. He understood how important it was to get elected. But he thought the war with Mexico was morally wrong. When he was elected to Washington, this is 1847, he gets to Washington, he and the Mexican War is going on, he defied the president to show him the exact spot where the Mexicans had invaded the country. And, of course, there was no such spot, but the newspapers began to call him Spotty Lincoln, and people in Springfield volunteered for the war in droves. There were some pretty prominent people who were killed during the Mexican War, and as a result, Lincoln knew that he could not be reelected to Congress, so he didn't try to run again after that term.
Well, I think one strange thing, and again, the connection with the Mexican War, is Santa Anna's Paul's leg is at the museum there, the military museum in Springfield today.
Yes, and there's also another, he had several cork legs. There's another one in Decatur, Illinois, because one of the people who fought in that war was Richard Oglesby, who later became governor of Illinois three different times, who fought at the Battle of Cerro Gordo, which gave the name not only to a street in Decatur, but also to a small town in central Illinois. And then Oglesby went on to participate in the gold rush of 1849, and that's how El Dorado, or El Dorado, as the locals pronounce it, Main Street Route US 36 through Decatur got its name.
Now, Abraham Lincoln, obviously, and when we read his writings today, he self-taught, became a totally literate man, incredible writing capability.
Yes.
But what you talk about, and this talked about the museum, and you're talking about in the book, his everyday speech was quite different from what he could write, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was, his oratory, I think there were several levels of language that Lincoln used. He was a raconteur. He loved to tell stories. And and most of his stories were, well, they weren't X-rated, but they were certainly R-rated. And I'll give you an example of one of his less salacious ones. He loved to tell a story about a sort of evangelical preacher who would get all fired up and try to get his congregation terrified of fire and brimstone of hell, and a small congregation at a rural country church. And he's preaching one Sunday, and a lizard was walking on the rafters above him. Anyhow, the lizard fell down and slipped between his shirt collar and his neck and went down into his clothes. So he's trying to pretend that there is no lizard crawling around inside of his clothes, and he starts wiggling and so forth. And anyhow, he says to the congregation, and this is what you have to do if you want to go to heaven. And all of a sudden, his pants fall off. And there's an old woman sitting in the front pew, and she stands up and she says, if that's what I have to do, I'm not going to heaven. That was one of his favorite stories. There's another one when he was running for Congress running against a firebrand Methodist preacher who accused Lincoln of atheism, and which Lincoln had to actually publish a denial of that. But in any event, he asked the preacher asked for a show of hands of all those who believed that they were going to heaven, and Lincoln doesn't raise his hand, you see, in the audience. So finally he turns to him, Lincoln, and he says, Mr. Lincoln, where are you going? And Lincoln says, I'm going to Washington.
Thank and, God he did.
Yeah, and that was the term of service that we were talking about during the Mexican War.
I think one of the things, again, with Lincoln, and one thing, again, we've all touched on it, and all of us have had the opportunity to stand on the site, is a famous Lincoln-Douglas debates.
Right.
I mean, that set the tone in this nation, didn't it? And, I mean, here are these debates out in the middle of nowhere between two individuals that probably should have never even been heard of, much less, I mean, how did the media and the press get the word around at that time? And they set the tone for the nation, didn't they?
Right, and well, it's true. The secret there is Lincoln's opponent. Stephen Douglas. And I have one of my books that is called People and Places in the Land of Lincoln, and I talk about Douglas quite a bit in that book. And by the way, Douglas was Lincoln's, I guess you could say, rival for the hand of Mary Todd. Unfortunately, she didn't like him, and so but he was trying to court Mary.
Great men.
Yeah, but Douglas, I think it would be safe to say, without exaggeration, that in the 15 years before the Civil War started in 1861, Douglas was on the committee both in the Congress and then later in the Senate, in the House and then in the Senate, that controlled statehood and the adding of new territory. This was a very important committee. You could say, and if you look at a map, you know, sort of a progressive map of the United States, how did the United States change in that period? Most of what we think of as the Western United States was added as either territory or an actual state. And the man behind all that was Stephen A. Douglas. He was a tremendous champion for national expansion, and he also was very big on, trying to get. He's the man who's chiefly responsible for the Trans-Pacific Railroad, which didn't get finished, until nearly the end of the war. So so he had a lot of press coverage following him, regardless. Lincoln was, virtually a nobody, except for his stint in Washington and his opposition to the Mexican War. He wasn't, giving many national speeches. It was during this period that Lincoln came home and basically lawyered and made some money. This is where Lincoln put money in the bank during that period between the Mexican War and his running against Douglas, which was 1858. Now, the way that it worked back then is that you got votes, but the senator was actually picked by the state legislature, and they picked Douglas. Lincoln, it was the only election that Lincoln lost, but he came very, very close. However, you're absolutely right. It gave them national exposure, mainly because of the telegraph, and both of them used trains. Now, this is interesting. Lincoln would arrive on just a regular train. Douglas had a special train with his own car, a luxury Pullman car, and trailing that was a flatbed car with a cannon. So when they'd come into a town to have the debate, Douglas would arrive early and they would fire the cannon. And this sort of gives you a difference of the style of the two men, Douglas was very, very ostentatious, flamboyant. Oratory tended to be very florid and long-winded, even though he certainly knew a lot of facts. People expected a 2 or 3 hour speech in those days. And getting back to what we're saying about the Gettysburg Address being short, they expected a long. And so generally, Lincoln would let Douglas go first, and then he would respond. And, of course, slavery was the big issue, as it was. Somewhere in one of my books, I say that it's hard to imagine a discussion, either in a tavern or after church or at a family gathering, between, let's say, 1832 or 1830, that's when Lincoln came to Illinois, and the beginning of the Civil War. It's hard to imagine any discussion that did not either start with or end with the issue of slavery.
The technology at that time was such that slavery was almost necessary in order to harvest the crops and everything. This is before the incredible industrial and technological
right.
developments, wasn't it?
Yeah, but this was in the South. We didn't, and it wasn't in any way. And this is an important point, because Lincoln did not want to His position on slavery evolved, and there are many African-American scholars today who criticize him bitterly for this, that he didn't free the slaves right away, that he wasn't right away interested in slavery, enfranchising the slaves and so forth. He originally thought that if we outlawed slavery and didn't free the ones who were still slaves in the South, that it would just die out of its own accord, because he did not want or did not see any possibility of slaves, you know, growing corn. They didn't grow soybeans in those days, but corn and wheat up north. And this is why, getting back to Stephen Douglas, every time a new state came into the Union, Doug, there was immediately bitter and rancorous debate about whether that was going to be a free state or a slave state. So it kept the discussion of slavery, the kettle was on the boil during the whole time, because, you know, the Southerners wanted to have as many slave states as possible so that they wouldn't lose their slaves and that they would have more representation in Congress, because they could see that the North was getting bigger and bigger.
One thing that's totally fascinating, you mentioned this, we were at a luncheon several years ago with you, which is kind of like one of those book luncheons where we're eating.
Oh, yes. I think that's when I first met you.
Yeah, it was. I think it was just sitting there in the conference room across the table eating lunch and having a discussion. But at that time, you mentioned, I mean, when we consider Lincoln and the impact he made and all his ideas and his concepts that he put forth, if I understood you correctly, to understand the book correctly, you know, again, I'm sitting here looking at the people and places in the land of Lincoln.
Uh-huh.
Abraham Lincoln himself was not a definitive religious man that loved any organized religion, did he?
You've hit the nail on the head, and then some. Lincoln had a lot of trouble with organized religion because I think he saw the contradictions. You have to remember, during this period, you had Catholic priests, Episcopalian ministers, Presbyterian ministers, Methodists, and so forth, North and South, all claiming that slavery was a good thing. That it was a good thing to be a slave. It took care of these people, and they should be grateful for being slaves. You know what Lincoln's response to that was? He said, "I've heard of a lot of men who want to own slaves, but I've never heard of one who wanted to be a slave." But that's not the whole story. When Lincoln's family lived in Kentucky still, his father lost, because of horrible record-keeping, he lost legal title to his land. And that's the main reason they moved over across the Ohio River onto the Indiana side. Now, crossing the Ohio River is kind of it's like crossing the Jordan, you know. You're going into the free state area. And one of the reasons neither his mother nor his father supported slavery. Lincoln's father, he might have been economically backward, but morally speaking, he belonged to a very progressive wing of the Baptist Church. At that time, they were called the Missionary Baptists. And what that meant is there were a lot of Baptists at that time who did not believe that they believed that they were elect and they were going to heaven and they weren't going to go out and recruit or proselytize to have any new members of the church. This new wing of the Baptist church believed in bringing in new members and bringing them officially into the congregation, if they would announce that they were saved. Now, that was what Lincoln's father did. And so when they came over to Indiana, he was in an environment that really was not a pro-slave environment. That doesn't mean that there weren't some people around. Certainly slavery was right across the river, right across the Ohio River. I have a poem about that I might just read a few lines from.
Yeah,
if you don't
please
mind.
Do. Please read many of your poems as we talk in here.
Yeah, but it just so happens it's right on what we're talking about. The poem is called Billy the Barber, and it's about a a free man of color who was one of Lincoln's close friends and who inspired Lincoln to realize what a black man could do given an equal opportunity. And Billy became a landowner. He was a musician. He raised money to and he had a barbershop in Springfield and so forth. And here, this poem is about Billy is the guy who shaved and barbered Lincoln on the day before he left to go to Washington. So he's one of the last people. And he also took care of their house while they were in Washington. And anyhow, this is supposed to be Lincoln thinking and talking here. Once on the Ohio River, I beheld a coffle of slaves. Now, coffle is an old word, but it basically means a chain gang. These were slaves that were linked to one another, ankle to ankle, with ankle cuffs and chains. Three men, two women, and a little girl. The oldest man had white woolly hair, and his back crawled with gray wormy scars, his eyes filled with the blankness of being sold downriver. How many are still in coffles? Well, it's a longer poem, but I wanted to read that little passage because Lincoln saw a lot of slaves on boats docking there in southern Indiana, and he certainly knew. He also made two trips to New Orleans on a riverboat, on a raft floating down the Mississippi, and he actually saw slaves being sold in the slave market.
This was all at the most formative years, right?
Exactly.
He's in his 20s, correct?
Exactly, yes, and even before his 20s. So he certainly, you know, he certainly knew. And then, as you said earlier, this is my own theory, but I really believe that even though it was legal at the time what Thomas Lincoln was doing, he was by the time Lincoln was 13, 14 years old, he could outwork a grown man easily. He was big and strong and particularly good at cutting down trees, and he would hire his son out to take care of hogs. Lincoln could pick up big 200-pound hogs and slaughter them and build pig pens, and he'd get dirty, rough jobs, but he'd get well paid for them. Thomas took all the money. He never gave his son one penny of that.
See, now, this is totally unique. I mean, whoever man became, probably in history will have to tell us, we don't even know yet, the greatest president in the history of the United States. But yet his background, where he became from, is a mud farmer.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to learn to do all of this different things. I mean, the technology at the time was obviously backward, but he was incorporated in everything that it was possible to use. I mean, he actually, in reading through your book again, he was totally, totally positive of trying to open up the Sangamon River to navigation.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And got
get everything in and out across Illinois.
Yeah, famous story. He helped, there was a riverboat once that made it all the way from Beardstown to on the Illinois River, made it up the Sangamon to Springfield, right outside of Springfield, and there was a landing there. And this was during the spring flooding. Well, when the water went down, the riverboat was trapped there, and Lincoln got some volunteers together. And this is kind of a good example of his, you know, political genius. He was able to talk a whole bunch of friends and people into this, and they basically waded out in waist-deep water and cut tree branches and cut stumps and things so that the riverboat was freed. But that was the end of attempts at riverboat traffic on that river. The other thing I think about, you mentioned this earlier, and for me, it's the distinguishing characteristic of Lincoln. He was technically what is called an autodidact, that is, somebody who can teach himself. So I'm so glad that you mentioned that several times. He taught himself. When they were living in southern Indiana, he had no pencil or paper. He would write any book that he could get his hands on. He would copy things and write them on a piece of a log or wood with charcoal, okay? He would also recite things over and over again. They used to drive his father crazy, too. But once Lincoln had learned something, he would never forget it.
So in other words, his brain was absolutely brilliant beyond comprehension.
Yes, and most people saw this tall, gawky guy with pants that were too short and an old umbrella, which he carried, I think, until he went to Washington. And they said it was it had been black, but the dye had changed color, so it was kind of greenish-black looking, tied together with a string, you know, and his old beaver hat. And they'd look at him and say, well, this is just a country bumpkin. But here was a guy that, when he was living at New Salem, read all of Blackstone's commentaries on English law, which is the foundation of all our common law in the United States. So basically taught himself the essentials of being a lawyer, and he did. He then interned or was an apprentice with two lawyers in Springfield after that. But he also, and this has really impressed me no end, he had a chance to get a job as a surveyor. Well, you have to know trigonometry. Lincoln just basically had a couple of months of schooling when he was in southern Indiana, and basically knew some long division, but that was about as sophisticated as his arithmetic was. Lincoln taught himself trigonometry.
That's astonishing.
Yeah. And he did this with no help whatsoever, did it all on his own. And I think, you know, this is, and even when he was running for the presidency, Lincoln was teaching himself German because he was pretty much convinced that he could get the German vote, and I'm guessing, unless I misread, it's either Scandinavian or German, your name, Doug, but he was angling for the German vote between Jacksonville and Alton, basically along the river. And that was almost solidly German. And he also bought interest in a German newspaper, which was called Illinois Staatsanzeiger, which, rough translation, Illinois State Reporter. And it would print articles favorable to Lincoln. And Lincoln did, in fact, capture that vote in the 1860 election.
That's pretty neat. You wrote a book, The Lincoln Poems.
Yes.
Could you tell us about those and maybe read two or three excerpts out of this book? It's incredible.
I thank you so much, Doug. Well, it's the book itself started out. I became interested in Lincoln and Ann Rutledge, and I was curious if they had really had a romance. And and I was thinking of writing a series of love poems showing that romance, cataloging that romance, so to speak. The then state historian is a wonderful guy named Tom Schwartz. He's now working as the state historian in Iowa, neighboring state of Iowa. But Tom had a lot to do with the present library and museum, but we happened to be serving on a committee together, and I mentioned to him that I was trying to work up some material on this, and he put me on to two articles that had just been printed a few years before, showing a lot of research that more than strongly suggested, but came right out and proved that Lincoln really did have a romance with Ann Rutledge. And so I started writing poems about Lincoln and Rutledge, and it just grew from there. And then I had the opportunity to read those. I read them to a Rotary group in Decatur, and then later I read them up at a conference on Midwestern writing up at Michigan State University in East Lansing. And that was the first time I'd sort of, you know, taken them out from under the wraps, and they both looked, they both got good reception. But I, at a certain point, I realized I wanted to do something bigger and a difference. So that's how the book came about. And I'm going to read, and I wound up reading lots of Lincoln history and going to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, even though it was some 60 miles from my house. But it was just wonderful. As you know, Doug, you can go in there, and if it's something about Lincoln that's in print, they've got it. Plus, you know, photographs and postcards and you name it.
People don't understand that you have the museum that you tour, but then they have the library associated with it that is a treasure trove of incredible, incredible research documents.
It's free to use, but you can't, it's a research library. You can't take anything out of the building. But, you know, you can use it the whole time you're there. And lots of times I'd just leave books piled up on the table and say, I'll be here tomorrow. And they just keep them for me until I got there again. I think I'll just read a couple of these. So I hit on the idea of, I've always been interested in monologues, you know, like Hamlet's monologue in Hamlet, the great to be or not to be speech, the soliloquy. And I thought about, well, what if Lincoln could speak about some of the many historical things that we know about, and how might it sound? And so I started experimenting along those lines. I'm going to read two kind of simple poems. One is called Pulling Teeth in Tremont. And the other thing, Tremont is one of the towns that Lincoln would stop at on the old Eighth Circuit when he would ride on his horse and go up there with Judge Davis and other lawyers to attend to legal business. And you have to realize that during this time, late 1830s and 1840s, all the legal business would usually be conducted in the county seat, and there weren't that many lawyers around. So you waited basically about every 3 months. The circuit riding court, which in this case was headed by Judge David Davis, whose mansion you can visit in Bloomington, Illinois, and for a couple of days the lawyers would stay there, and Judge Davis would hold court, and wills and lawsuits, and most of the lawsuits were either divorce or things like theft of a farm animal or something like that. But there were a lot of lawsuits for slander. You know, people would sue one another because they had been slandered, and occasionally there was a murder trial. And there was a famous one. In fact, just to show you how small world it is, I was in Decatur earlier this afternoon and stopped to get a cup of coffee, and there were some people talking there, and I thought one of them was a fellow that I recognized, and turned out it was, and I told him, I said, well, you could be his brother, and turned out that he had a relative who was at that trial. It's called the Almanac trial. Maybe I may read that one, too. Let me just read a very short one. This is about, as I said, Tremont, Illinois, and this is Lincoln reacting to what happened to him. This is, again, I based all these poems on historically documented events, and we know that on October 20th in 1841, a dentist in Tremont, Illinois, pulled out one of Lincoln's teeth, but also pulled out part of the jawbone. And so for days, Lincoln couldn't talk. He couldn't eat. He could just sip fluids. And it was a very frustrated time. And I imagined how Lincoln must have felt. And this is a humorous poem in which Lincoln contemplates whether he should sue this dentist. So this is called Pulling Teeth in Tremont. Woe to this petty tyrant of Tremont, a terrible tooth extractor, with talents more suited to veterinarian practice and teeth of equine or bovine proportions. Why, I shall sue him. By what authority does he torture unsuspecting victims in his hard wooden chair? And you have to remember that in this time, if you went to the dentist, you know, there was no anesthetic, no laughing gas, and they had a handheld drill. It would drill into your hand, like into your teeth, as if it were a piece of wood, removing the tooth while shattering the tender and protective jaw. Now, unable to eat or speak, I seek just compensation and punitive damages for having lost those unappreciated faculties that make me singularly human. As Lincoln loved to tell stories, so not being able to talk must have been sheer hell for him.
The Almanac trial is probably, I mean, it's been portrayed in movie upon movie of Lincoln since the first time of movies. And again, the story of the Almanac trial here, could you kind of go over that for us, please?
It's a little complicated, but basically what it boils down to is that the son of one of Lincoln's friends, and I'm trying to find my place here. Yeah, here we go. One of his friends from New Salem, her son was accused of murder. Okay. And the eyewitness, or the apparent eyewitness, claimed that they could see him because it was a very bright moonlit night. Okay, so the whole the prosecution's case turned on that one fact, and the guy's name was Duff Armstrong. And there were a lot of Armstrongs in and around New Salem, living in a little village called Clary's Grove. And so the mother had appealed to Lincoln. Lincoln, even though it was out of his normal area of activity, the trial was moved to Beardstown, which is quite a bit west. And Lincoln, at the peak of the trial, pulls out a farmer's almanac and goes back to the day that the murder, or the evening that the murder is supposed to have taken place, and shows that in the almanac there was no moon that night. and then it's not only that, but Lincoln made a very emotional appeal to the lawyer, to the jury, with tears in his eyes, and people were crying. It's not a typical Lincoln performance. It wasn't intellectual at all. I mean, or based on law or reason. It was more like Perry Mason than Abraham Lincoln. But everything was stacked against Duff, and Lincoln won the trial.
Now the other thing too, and it's been brought up in your books, and you've got a poem on it, the lost speech, because this is probably the one effort of Lincoln's that launched him to where he became, wasn't it?
It certainly was, in the sense that it showed he had the power to move people and to move them very powerfully. I'm trying to find that now, and I can't seem to.
Like page 81 on the book.
Okay, you're ahead of me. Yeah, there we are. Where it is, right there. I can read that one if you like.
Give a little background, yeah, and then read it.
By the way, I should mention that in this book, every one of the poems is preceded with a little historical, very short essay, a little story, so that the reader, it doesn't tell the reader this is how you should interpret the poem or anything like that. It just gives them the basic background, what I knew when I started writing the poem. I think everybody has to read a poem pretty much for themselves. You make the poem. The author doesn't. The author puts it on the paper, and you have to create it in your head and with your own voice and so forth. I absolutely believe that. But the law speech took place on May 29th, 1856, and it was in Bloomington, Illinois. It was at the Illinois State Republican Convention, so Lincoln was speaking to the choir. And what's important about this is that there were many people in the audience, including Lincoln's law partner, Billy Herndon, and who was taking notes on the speech and was so moved by it that he dropped his pencil and just listened. He didn't want to write. It was apparently an incredibly powerful performance, very emotional, perhaps more like a revivalist preacher than a politician. I mean, he was just on fire that night, and he moved everyone. So It's a short poem, so I'll read that one. It's called The Lost Speech, May 29th, 1856. Even now, it lingers on the tip of my tongue, the words splitting silence like an axe blade through hickory. Suddenly, there is a clearing in the woods, light pooling in the cloistered space, and for the briefest moment of grace, we are transcendent and complete in a godlike communion of words. Some truth revealed, we embrace our quotidian lives as the moment fades and disappears. So I think the poem is about what every speaker, I think, sometimes experiences, a moment where you're in total communication with the audience, and it's really a spiritual moment. There's a lot of religious language in that poem. I think that Lincoln certainly felt he had done something really great. But there's no text. We have no handwritten copy. Apparently it was extemporaneous. And no newspaper reporter. We have some summaries. We know it was about slavery, but we don't know, you know, we don't have any of the details of the speech.
Once upon a time, I had a Cherokee shaman told me to speak from the heart when I give a talk. And It sounds like, I mean, with Abraham Lincoln, obviously he prepared a lot, but he also spoke from the heart, from the deep part of the heart and the deepest part of the soul.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's like, if I can tell a little story here, Doug, when I was in graduate school, the first article I ever published in an academic journal, I don't know how old I was, this is probably around 25 or 26, something like that. And I was getting close to getting my PhD, and I went to see my mentor and advisor, who was a guy from Illinois, by the way, from Harvard, Illinois. In fact, I talked about him last Friday night when you saw me. And really fine person. And unfortunately, he died about 2 years after I moved to Illinois, so I didn't have the pleasure of showing him any of my books, which would have been a real pleasure to do. But anyhow, his name was Dick Adams. But anyhow, when I published this article, I went into his office. In those days, things were still all letterpress, you know, and if you published something, you got what were called the galley proofs, and these were just a long roll of paper with whatever you had published, you know, printed on it on one long strip. And you were supposed to check it for any, you know, inaccuracies or misspellings or anything that you wanted to change at the last minute before it was printed. So I brought it into his office, and he just looked at it, didn't say a word, and he took both hands and went sideways like this, figuring out, you know, making blocks of text with his hands, figuring out how many pages this thing was going to be when it was printed. And I was just there, you know, full of myself, puffing out my chest, you know, really proud of the thing. And while he's doing this, I blurted out, you know, I wrote that in one afternoon, and this is technically true. I did type it on an electric typewriter, no computers in those days, in one afternoon. He didn't say a word, and, man, it got really silent and close in that office. And finally he turned to me and he said, "You've been writing this your whole life." And I think that's, you know,
with Lincoln. Are available through Mayhaven Publishing, and this is in a small town here. And so everything like that, we'll put that up. This has been an incredible conversation. We'll continue on with this stuff. Dan, thank you for everything you've done. Thank you for joining us on Warrior Connection. Ladies and gentlemen, next week we're going to have Dr. Bart Billings on PTSD. Again, he's been on the this radio network, and thank you and good evening. Thank you again, Dan.